Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that the 2016 election could be contested, following a question by NPR's Terry Gross, who asked Hillary Clinton, "Would you completely rule out questioning the legitimacy of this election if we learned that the Russian interference in the election was even deeper than we know?" To which Hillary Clinton replied, "No, I wouldn't rule it out." An expert on the history of presidential elections and election chicanery, the author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, investigative journalist Andrew Gumbel, joins us. We'll discuss how at least two presidents, Samuel Tilden in 1876 and Al Gore in 2000, won the popular vote and the Electoral College but lost their elections, and look into the possibility of a do-over if the special counsel Robert Mueller were to find compelling evidence that the combination of Russian active measures, voter roll hacking, and campaign collusion was sufficient to swing the election, given the narrow 77,000 vote margin Trump won the Electoral College by. Then we'll assess the chances of the effort underway to repeal Obamacare with the Graham-Cassidy bill that is being pushed through the Senate ahead of a September 30 deadline. Michael Hitzig, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Los Angeles Times, joins us to discuss this wolf in sheep's clothing that is being cast as a moderate common sense alternative to the draconian repeal bills that have floundered so far, and his latest article at the Los Angeles Times, "The GOP's Last-Ditch Obamacare Repeal May Be the Worst One Ever." Yet, I should say. Then finally, we will speak with Aziz Huq, professor of law at the University of Chicago, who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, "How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack?" and express his concern that, like Syria and North Korea, Trump will seize on fiery bluster and dramatic threats and treat a terrorist tragedy as a campaign event, as he has done with the recent hurricanes in Texas and Florida. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Matters. And his latest book just out is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And as I mentioned on NPR's Terry Gross's program today, Hillary Clinton amped things up a little bit in response to a question, which I mentioned before. Would you completely rule out questioning the legitimacy of this election if we learned that the Russian interference in the election was even deeper than we know? To which Hillary Clinton said, "No, I wouldn't rule it out." I know there's no constitutional provision for a do-over, but let's start with an historical context, at least, which you have done, of course, in your book, Down for the Count. And as I mentioned, at least two American presidents won their elections, both in the Electoral College and in the popular vote, but yet did not become presidents.
Well, let me correct that a little bit. The Electoral College is what determines who becomes president, and in both cases, the Electoral College came down in favor of the winner. However, whether they would have done under other circumstances is the question at hand. In 1876, a tremendously contentious election in the wake of the Civil War, by any fair measure, both at the time and looking back historically, Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, won fair and square over Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican. However, three southern states were in the hands of carpetbagger Republican governments, and they refused to declare that Tilden had won their states. And there was a long crisis at the end of which the Grand Compromise was struck, whereby Reconstruction ended, which is effectively the occupation of the South by Northern troops. And Hayes, even though he hadn't won the election, became president. That was precedent number one, which was shocking enough to anybody who cares about the concept of universal suffrage, which in 1876 was not only well established in the United States, but was becoming the norm across the rest of Europe and the rest of the developed world. The other example, which got much less publicity, was the 2000 election, which, of course, featured that tremendous 36-day battle in Florida at the end. The Supreme Court decided that the votes should not be fully counted. George Bush won by default in Florida and therefore won the Electoral College and the presidency. What we found out close to a year later, when two media consortia got a hold of all the physical ballots in Florida and counted them all using varying standards, is two very interesting findings, one of which was highlighted by the main national newspapers, which is that had the recounts requested by the Gore camp gone ahead, Gore probably would have lost anyway, except under the laxest of standards. But the much more clamorous finding, which was highlighted in one or two Florida papers, but not in the New York Times or the Washington Post, is that had there been a full manual recount of the whole state, which neither party requested, but which would have incontrovertibly been the democratically correct thing to do, Al Gore, by any standards, would have prevailed. So we had actual physical proof that had the election gone ahead as, you know, most people understand elections should go ahead by counting the votes, we ended up with the wrong person winning, which is something that at the time was quietly glossed over. Bush was in the White House. There was nothing to be gained from it. Al Gore didn't say a peep, and the world moved on. What we're seeing now is a very interesting hypothetical situation, which is, let's say, and we do not know that this will come about, some kind of evidence comes along to question whether Trump really won in those agonizingly close states in the Midwest, and therefore whether he really deserved to get those Electoral College votes that made him president. What will Hillary Clinton do about it? Now, the precedent in the past is not to rock the boat. You know, this is not a country where elections are gentlemanly pursuits. They're vicious, nasty, drag-out fights. And, you know, the understanding with both parties has always been, if you end up losing, you know, after a contest, after whatever you choose to do in the immediate aftermath of the election, then the appropriate response is not to keep fighting, but to lick your wounds, go away, raise more money, and fight harder and dirtier next time and hope you win then. Which is what Richard Nixon, by the way, did. He felt he was cheated in 1960. There were a number of people clamoring for him to contest the election, you know, for weeks, months on end. And he told a journalist friend of his, you know, those are very interesting stories you're writing, but nobody steals the presidency of the United States. So he made a conscious decision. I'm not going to make myself political poison by pushing this any further. And of course, he had ambitions to try again. In Hillary Clinton's case, she's probably made the determination that she's not going to run again. Some people would dispute that. I think the publication of the book is evidence of that. She's a very cautious person. She's rather less cautious in this book than she's been in the past on the campaign trail, which suggests to me at least that she's not ambitious for high office anymore. And she feels like she's out for justice. And we don't know how this is going to play out. First of all, we don't know if the evidence is going to appear. But even if it does, and even if she starts trying to cry foul, we don't know what impact this would have. She says herself in the Terry Gross interview that there's very little, if any, constitutional grounds for a do-over. But it would create an interesting question, on the one hand, over Trump's legitimacy, and also, on the other hand, whether it's really smart to relitigate the 2016 election when the world has moved on. And maybe the smart thing for the Democrats and anybody who opposes Trump and wants to see him out of office as quickly as possible, whether Hillary Clinton is really your ideal champion. These are things that we will have to wait and see how they play out.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book just out is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Well, still, you know, the fact that somebody won an election by 3 million votes and didn't become president. No other country in the world has such a screwy system as the Electoral College. And one would think that after the examples that we've just talked about and others, Andrew, that it would be time to jettison the whole thing. Of course, it's not going to happen, but it could happen. There's a way to do it at a state level. But without having to go through a constitutional amendment. But I'm not sure that that's on the cards. But the one thing that's so different about this situation today is that the involvement of a hostile foreign power. I mean, that's never happened before. It's been dirty pool, Democrats versus Republicans, and pulling out all kinds of mischief, pulling off all kinds of mischief. But nobody's ever had this situation before where a hostile foreign power has apparently meddled, and the extent of it is not entirely clear, but it seems to be very multifaceted. I've heard reports that the Kremlin dedicated something like $5 billion to this massive intelligence operation. So it's at the end of the day, it could yield something.
Right. Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, as far as we know, it's never happened before in the United States. But of course, it's happened in other countries, and it's been, in many cases, the United States doing the manipulation from afar. And it's probably instructive to look at what those countries have done in response. You know, one instance that I'm very familiar with is Italy, where I lived for a long time. The Americans, you know, clearly manipulated the results of the first big election after the Second World War, which was the one that the Communist Party looked most likely to win in 1948. They were literally stuffing suitcases full of cash and handing them to party leaders, spreading disinformation, turning a blind eye to the mafia being recruited to intimidate people in Sicily so that they wouldn't vote for the Communist Party, and on and on. And what this created was, you know, a stunted democracy, I think it's fair to say, in Italy, in which there was an abiding resentment of the United States and in which there was rampant corruption, including corruption that involved the intelligence services and, you know, links to the CIA and other parts of the American establishment that were encouraging acts of violence, whatever it took to keep the communists out of power. The years of lead in the 70s and the early 80s in Italy were, you know, without any doubt, inspired, if not also directly funded and encouraged to some degree by shadier parts of the U.S. establishment. And, you know, Italy is, you can argue, is still suffering from the results, that there has never, you know, there are ways in which their democracy has not been as deeply rooted, you know, even 70 years after the fall of fascism, than it might otherwise have been. And I think, you know, that we need to think carefully about the consequences of ignoring this. On the other hand, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that the United States has its own longstanding historical problems in terms of having, you know, a dispassionate electoral system that is run in a nonpartisan, professional way. This is something that has eluded this country. Most other advanced countries have figured out a way to do it, at least, you know, mostly correctly. The United States has been, you know, plagued by problems of one kind or another. And of course, part of the reason for that is the long legacy of segregation in the South, the fact that, you know, African Americans were not accorded the proper right to vote for far too long. And even now, there is no formal enshrined right to vote in the Constitution. And it's something that hangs over the country and makes dirty elections of the kind that we saw in 2016 and many times in the past, you know, an imminent possibility. And I think it's worth ramming home the point that while Hillary Clinton is justly concerned and others are justly concerned about Russian interference, justly concerned about the interference of James Comey, as the FBI director, putting his thumb on the scale just a few days before the election, and all the other things that she's been talking about, you know, it was not a one-way street. That electioneering is a dirty business, as I said before, and it does run both ways. And sometimes one side will be more effective in their dirty campaigning than the other. Sometimes, you know, the dirty campaigning won't work because the candidate on the other side is too strong. So it's a complex situation. And, you know, while I think it's absolutely essential to get to the bottom of what the Russians did or did not do, it's a foreign policy issue, it's a national security issue, as well as an issue of democratic integrity. I think it's also important to look at the electoral system as a whole and the nature of politics in this country. And sadly, you know, it is not a question of waiting for the grown-ups to come along and say, let's do this properly because we have rules. We don't have rules. And so what we have is a political determination of where we go from here. And we have a very poisoned political environment right now with Trump and Kris Kobach trying to poison public opinion in the sense that they want them to think that voter fraud is rampant of a kind that doesn't actually exist, and that, you know, take the emphasis off money in politics, off dirty electioneering through social media, through all these channels that we saw in 2016. In other words, you know, there's a battle over the politics of elections, which is over the heads of most voters. And that is a very dangerous situation. And I think Hillary Clinton needs to think long and hard whether she wants to engage in that fight or whether, in fact, the smarter way to go is to hold her fire for the Democrats to figure out a political strategy to get rid of Trump and his ilk and that strain of Republican extremist politics as fast as possible and work on reforming the system, you know, once they get to that spot. You know, it's a political calculation as well as a calculation of the health of the democracy that we live in.
Well, indeed. But meanwhile, Trump, through his appointments, is doing enormous damage to the country in the eyes of Democrats. And in particular, what you've just mentioned, the Kovacs Commission, which the vice president co-chairs with Kovacs, is full of these zealots who... voter suppression zealots is the only other way to describe them. And that, it would be appalling if they were able to... I mean, essentially, they were created because Trump made these outrageous charges because he couldn't accept the fact that he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. So he came up with this idea that 3 million undocumented Mexicans voted. And these this commission is out trying to create laws to justify that massive lie. It's a horrible situation.
Right. You know? I mean, I would agree that what they're doing is contemptible in every conceivable way. I would also point out that I think politically it has had a number of setbacks. You know, we saw in the summer when Kovacs sent out a letter to the states asking for a vast amount of individual data on voters, you know, things that he should never have been asking for, including their party affiliation, which, of course, has nothing to do with the integrity of the vote. Other things, including, you know, status, addresses, personal details of military families, which is something the Pentagon has worked very hard for decades to keep out of the public domain for security reasons of those families and the military as a whole, and on and on. You know, this got a terrible backlash from Republicans as well as Democrats. There's a great deal of skepticism about Kovacs and his commission. And then again, just a week ago, when they held their first proper public meeting, the second official meeting, but the first one that the public was allowed to participate in New Hampshire, and Kovacs came out on the eve of the meeting saying that New Hampshire had been, quote unquote, stolen, that Trump should have won there, and Maggie Hassan should never have won the Senate seat from Kelly Ayotte. The entire congressional delegation in New Hampshire rose up and said, this is outrageous. The Secretary of State, who sits on Kovacs Commission, was at first reluctant to say anything, and then he came out publicly and said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the process by which we conducted our elections. So we're seeing a lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you look individually at what Trump is doing, and of course, you know, it's, you know, nobody on the other side of the political fence, and quite a few people on the Republican side of the fence, are not happy about the fact that Trump is in the White House. I'm not trying to minimize that. But we're seeing ways in which politically he is getting defeated in significant issues. You know, there's a question whether you raise the issue of his legitimacy in terms of the vote count as a political issue, whether that's a winnable issue or whether it is smarter and more efficient to hold your fire and wait for the next election and beat the Republicans and beat Trump, you know, next time around. I'm not advocating for one or the other. I'm merely saying that the history of this country shows that elections are an eminently political battlefield. They're not one where, you know, the rights and wrongs of how elections should be conducted is ever an argument that gets very far, unfortunately. But that's just the reality.
Well, clearly, Hillary Clinton's in a difficult position because, you know, she is, the more she talks about the Russians and Comey and other factors which contributed to her loss, we don't know the extent to which the Russians contributed to her loss. She's accused of shifting responsibility away from herself and the campaign that she ran. But just let's just assume, though, that Mueller, who has a lot of integrity and a lot of respect, comes out with a really definitive proof that the Russians, through their $5 billion active measures campaign, which was multifaceted, and now we're starting to learn all kinds of stuff about they actually had agents on the ground in these various swing states. Maybe just to speculate in closing that if it came from Mueller's lips, that it almost came out of Comey's testimony, frankly, if it comes from Mueller's lips that this last election was stolen by the Russians, what do we do then?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, constitutionally, I think, you know, most constitutional scholars will tell you there is nothing you can do. You know, the Congress has the option of impeaching the president, but it does not have the option of ordering up a new election. And, you know, the United States is very different in that respect from parliamentary democracies around the world. You know, in Britain in 1990, I remember when Margaret Thatcher, you know, from one day to the next, was pushed off her perch as prime minister by her own party members. I remember Americans I knew was, you know, shaking their heads in wonder and saying, how is this possible? And the answer is, you know, in a parliamentary system, you have that option. In a presidential system, especially one where the rules say, you know, the elections happen every 4 years and there's an electoral college and they decide who the president's going to be. And the only way to get rid of him or her is, you know, either by impeachment or through the mechanisms laid out in the 25th Amendment. Those are the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of stuck with them. And I think, you know, probably, you know, I think we've all got broken crystal balls at this point, but probably if something like that came along, you know, there would be a number of political decisions to be made. Number one, about impeachment. Number two, about a response to the Russians. Number three, about possible reform of the electoral system and or, you know, cybersecurity issues to prevent this or to do everything you could to prevent this happening again. You know, I think this would, I think it's probably not an exaggeration to say that one way or the other, it would be a significant psychological shock and check on the notion of American power, because there would be only so much you could do about it.
Well, Andrew Gumbel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing the chances of the efforts underway to repeal Obamacare with the Cassidy-Graham bill that is being pushed through the Senate ahead of a September 30th deadline. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment business, and currently he has a twice-weekly column, Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to the lives in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal and Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is The GOP's Last-Ditch Obamacare Repeal Bill May Be the Worst One Yet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thanks, Michael. And it does appear that this Cassidy-Graham bill, Senator Graham of South Carolina and Cassidy of Louisiana, himself a doctor, could actually repeal Obamacare. I mean, it's an odd situation to be. We've just had Bernie Sanders and 15 Democrats step up and say they're in favor of single payer. Some of the Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, thought it was a bad idea to sort of, you know, talk about a chimeric possibility as opposed to fight the good fight now, because the Republicans aren't done with trying to repeal Obamacare. And here's the evidence, right, that they're not done with it. And in fact, it looks as though that Cassidy and Graham could pull this one off.
Well, it's still pretty unclear whether they can get, they really need to get to 50 votes so that Vice President Pence can cast a deciding vote to pass this thing, and it looks like they have at least two senators who would vote it down, maybe more. You know, one of the odd things about this bill is that Cassidy, Bill Cassidy, who, as you said, is a physician, actually worked with Senator Collins, Susan Collins of Maine, earlier this year to craft a Republican proposal that as I wrote at the time, and even subsequently, was not great. You know, it wasn't a good repeal proposal, but it wasn't nearly as insane as some of the others that have come down the pike. And yet now he's turned around, and he's created with Senator Graham and a couple of other Republicans this proposal that really is beyond horrific. I mean, it goes to the horrific level and then keeps going. It would completely eviscerate the American healthcare system. It would cost states billions and billions of dollars over the next 6 years. And then after 2026, there would be nothing left. There would be no federal healthcare program to speak of. There would be almost nothing left of Medicaid. There would certainly not be subsidies for people buying insurance on the individual market. And all of the protections that we actually got used to under Obamacare, protection for people with pre-existing conditions, requirement that every health plan has minimal benefits, including maternity and hospitalization, mental health coverage, and prescriptions. Those could be gone if a state wanted them gone. So this is really a crazy bill, and the idea that it's coming this close is really pretty disturbing.
Well, as you describe it, Michael Hussig, one would think then that Rand Paul, who thinks it doesn't go far enough to repeal Obamacare, that he should maybe change his mind, because, one of the bizarre things about the Cassidy-Graham bill is that all of those senators all of those governors, particularly in the red states, who refuse to take Medicaid money are rewarded, whereas the states that did take it and have put it to use wisely and well get punished. I mean, it's totally nuts.
Yeah, although obviously, one of the imponderables and one of the strange things about this is that Rand Paul's state, which is Kentucky, actually had been one of the leaders in embracing the Affordable Care Act, and they did expand Medicaid. So that state would basically be on the hook. They would lose, in 1 year alone, in 2026, they lose $3 billion compared to what they're getting under the ACA. That would be, they lose $3 billion in 2026 compared to what they're getting from Medicaid expansion and subsidies for their residents. So, Paul's always been in sort of this odd situation, representing a state that did very well under the Affordable Care Act, and yet he's one of the most conservative opponents, and you can see why he says this doesn't go far enough. It still leaves a lot in place for six or 8 years, which really diehard Republican opponents of healthcare reform, just think is untenable.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hussig, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment industry, and he currently writes a twice-weekly column, Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to the lives of Californians. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is The GOP's Last-Ditch Obamacare Repeal Bill May Be the Worst One Yet. But just touch on the vote count, because obviously Lindsey Graham is very close to Senator McCain, whose vote was key to scuttling the last repeal of Obamacare. The governor of the state of Arizona is weighing in against McCain, and I presume his friend Lindsey Graham, who's a co-sponsor of this bill, is privately urging him to jump aboard. And we don't know about the senator from Alaska, Murkowski, either, do we? She's wavering, isn't she?
Well, I don't know if she's wavering. All I can say is all we know is that she voted against the last bill, which was not as bad as this one. There's nothing in this bill that's an improvement over the last bill, and Alaska would lose money under this bill. So it's hard to see what would turn her around. I think the only thing about Murkowski is that she hasn't spoken out. Collins of Maine, I think, is probably clearly a no. If Paul is a no, well, then they've only got 48 votes. That's not enough. Or rather, that would give them 50 votes, so they really do need one more to bail out. So it's really hard to read right now. This bill is fairly new. As with the last bill, it's not going to be subjected to hearings. The Congressional Budget Office, which has to analyze any bill that comes to the Senate floor, has said it'll be able to produce a sketchy analysis of this bill sometime next week, but is not going to be able to analyze things like the effect on the number of people who lose their coverage, the actual cost to states, the things that are really important. And that means that senators will essentially be voting on something that looks like it would cost 30 million Americans their coverage, but they won't know for sure. And by the way, if it is 30 million or 32 million, which is the way the CBO scored the last bill that was similar to this, that would be half again as many people losing their coverage as the bills that got voted down. The last Senate bill would have cost about 20 million Americans their health coverage. This is going to be 30 million. It's, as I said, it's very hard to see how this is an improvement and how this is something that senators would want to vote for.
So what's the pressure here to push it through before September 30th? And also a part of why you can't count this one out.
Yeah, the September 30th is the deadline for passing this bill under the rules of reconciliation, which means it would only need 50 votes. After September 30th, any bill would need 60 votes to avoid a filibuster. So that's the hard deadline. I think the only thing, you know, we can say is that Republicans are really determined to make good on this promise that they've been making for years, that they will repeal Obamacare. And they care more about sort of showing that they kept faith with their hard right base than with sitting down and saying, well, what should we do with the healthcare system in the United States? What should it look like? What's the Senate's and Congress's role? They don't really care that much about that. They really just care about the sort of symbolic vote, which the risk is it would be more than symbolic and it would cost, it would eviscerate the American healthcare system. It would cost 30 million people their coverage. It would destroy Medicaid. It would just have incredibly bad impacts on millions and millions and millions of Americans. And the fact that they're proceeding with this is really shameful.
Well, it's also, I think, should be a wake-up call for people who see Lindsey Graham as this moderate, reasonable fellow. Now, maybe the bar has been lowered by Trump to the point where anybody that's not totally nuts is seems like a statesman. But still, you know, this is nasty, cruel, horrible, and yet he comes across as a reasonable person. And Cassidy, by the way, I don't know whether you watched the confirmation hearings for Betsy DeVos, but he was shamefully sycophantic towards her in a way that was just absolutely turned your stomach. He didn't come across.
I think that just tells you that when you scratch a Republican, so-called moderate, you find a hard right lunatic underneath. Graham has been moderate on a few things, but really something like this, there's just no moderation in this bill whatsoever. It's worse than every other bill. It gives states the authority, if they ask it, to basically to destroy all protections for people with pre-existing medical conditions. The only thing you can say for this campaign is that people in the public, people in Washington who were interested in healthcare reform, they took their eyes off the ball because everybody assumed that this was all over, that the last vote was the last vote, and then this thing comes up sort of bubbling out of the muck and mire, and here we're back to this debate again when everybody is sort of tired of it. So, you know, maybe they'll try to slip it through, but I think that now that it's out there, the attention of the reform wing is really now engaged, and, you know, we're going to go back through, you know, another sequence of pressure on senators to vote this thing down.
Right, but apart from your article, Michael Hiltzik, I haven't seen a lot that would indicate that the Democrats are mobilizing to stop this thing and to get the word out to the public how terrible it is. I mentioned in the beginning the Bernie Sanders and the 15 senators getting together the other day to talk about single payer, and some people think that's the case of the perfect being the enemy of the good. Well, at this point, what's facing the American people is something that's so bad that they better get their act together and stop it. They don't have a lot of time.
Well, I think you're beginning to see that, you know, basically toward the end of last week and the beginning of this week. I think you will see a lot more in the next few days, a lot more mobilization, a lot more attention in the press and on TV to this thing. And, you know, I think you're going to see the opposition to this reaching a critical mass fairly quickly. And the fact that it didn't happen until now, well, the bill just came up, really. It sort of, you know, emerged out of nowhere and started to look like a threat just really in the last few days.
But the CBO won't be able to score it, so you won't have that evidence of how terrible it is.
Yeah, the CBO says it will be able to score some elements of it. And the question is going to be, since in the Senate they have to have a CBO score to vote on anything on the floor, the question is... Is what the CBO is going to score enough? And that's it's just a little bit hard to say. But the CBO has said we are not going to have a complete score for this. So,
well,
yeah, and you know, it basically said it will not be able to provide, you know, precise estimates of the effects on the deficit, on health insurance coverage, or premiums, not for several weeks, which would put it beyond the September 30th deadline. So the question is, can this be spun by Republican leadership to look like the CBO has analyzed enough? And
right.
It's an open question.
Well, and you've got these this wolf in sheep's clothing in the form of Lindsey Graham, who's seen as a moderate. And, you know, this is that's the way this is being cast, is it not, as a moderate common sense alternative to the earlier bills. But it turns out to be even more draconian than the earlier bills. So
I think what you'll see is that I don't think Graham's reputation as a moderate will carry this by itself. There's going to be enough coverage. You know, I wrote a column today. My colleague out of Washington, Noam Levy, he wrote a piece about the bill today. So we had two stories just in the Los Angeles Times alone. You are going to see a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think you will see the opposition exposing the flaws of this bill very, very quickly. Yeah. And look, they're trying to push it through. They tried to push it through without much attention on it. And I think that element of their campaign has failed because now attention is being focused very strongly on it.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He received the Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry. He writes a twice-weekly column, Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to the lives of Californians. And his latest book is The New Deal of Modern History. And he's an article at the Los Angeles Times, The GOP's Last-Ditch Obamacare Repeal, Maybe the Worst One Yet. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about what would happen if there were what would Trump do if there were a terrorist attack on the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And he has an op-ed in The Guardian, How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack? Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haque.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
Well, thanks, Aziz. And Why did you write this? Was it something to do with the way Trump responded to the terror attack in London, where he clearly spewed out classified information, which Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, had to rebuke him for? And as you know, the British don't like to criticize the Americans because they somewhat defer to them. So did that prompt you to write this piece?
Ian, to be frank, it was really the cumulative responses to a number of crises that we've seen unfurling over the last few months that pushed me to write the piece. So we've had an ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria involving the use of chemical weapons. We've had the crisis over North Korean missile tests. And then the sequence of natural disasters, Irma and Hugo, that have presented the president to the White House with really an opportunity to show how they respond to serious crises. And I think that we've learned a good deal from observing the ways in which the White House has pivoted on those crises.
Well, the impression I get is that it becomes a public relations effort, or at least it's a question about how Trump appears in the media as opposed to how he deals with the problems.
I think that's right. I think we've seen here a White House that much more so than the normal White House is driven by a desire to appear to be responding, but also more importantly, to have the president appear to be or to use the crisis as a way of burnishing the credentials or the appearance or even the ego of the president. And that, even in comparison to any other president I can think of, it's really new. Especially when you couple it with an ongoing failure to find a meaningful way of grappling with the underlying forces that are causing the crisis. And that's been true in Syria, where the administration really has stepped completely aside after its single very high-profile attack. It's been the case with North Korea, where the level of rhetoric has been in striking contrast to the failure of the administration to muster any new substantial diplomatic initiatives that might alter North Korea's behavior. And it was true for Irma and for Hugo, where, you know, although you had various actual agency-level responses in the form of FEMA, and you had reasonably competent state-level responses, although maybe we'll find out those are not as competent as one might have hoped. The White House's response was to treat both of these hurricanes as platforms for the president to make some speeches. So it's very similar behavior we've seen in the campaign, very similar behavior we've seen while he's been governing. You know, I think the Boy Scout speech, for example, exemplified the same kind of tendencies. And it's a deeply worrying tendency when one thinks about the kinds of serious crises, these crises that might be coming down the pike.
And again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack? Well, the worst aspect, I think, of Trump's bluster and bellicose words, particularly back and forth with the North Korean leader, who is famous for his hyperbole, it doesn't seem to be very useful to lower yourself to the level of Kim Jong-un, because as you see TV footage of South Koreans in the street commenting on the crisis, and of course Seoul is at ground zero for if there were to be a war between the U.S. and North Korea, the collateral damage would be 10 million South Koreans in Seoul, and by and large, the refrain that you hear from the man in the street or the woman in the street in Seoul is that Kim Jong-un is crazy and so is Trump. So that's not a good position for the United States to be in.
I think the situation is a little worse than that, in as much as one of the moves that the White House has made is to threaten, at least in its public statement, a trade war or a diminution or a cutting off of trade ties with South Korea, which obviously has escalated tensions directly with South Korea, in addition to the tensions created by the president's criticism of China and Russia on the North Korea issue. The net effect of these, I think, precipitous and perhaps not fully thought through comments is to drive wedges within the international coalition that did exist to contain and limit Kim Jong-un's regime. And this splintering and tension between different elements of the international coalition is really only to the benefit of North Korea. And so what we've seen here is a series of actions that, ironically, by seeking to look tough, end up redounding to the benefit of the North Korean regime.
Well, when just on the domestic side, though, there's been an obvious double standard in Trump's comments. He, of course, was said nice things about the Nazis who demonstrated in Charlottesville. He didn't say a word about the attack on a mosque in Minnesota, and he didn't say a word about the cold-blooded murder of a bunch of worshippers in a mosque in Quebec. But then he talks about, you know, thousands of Muslims celebrating in New Jersey on 9/11, which never happened. Has he already eroded his credibility in terms of this double standard where, you know, Christo-fascists, for the want of a better description, if they can murder people in Charlottesville, they get a mild rebuke, if anything. And, you know, meanwhile, he makes up all kinds of paranoid notions about Muslims, terrorists under the bed.
Just to be fair to the administration, other officials such as the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, I disagree with many of the positions that Attorney General Sessions has taken, but after Charlottesville, Sessions took a very hard line on the neo-Nazi protesters, and many other elements of the administration have distanced themselves. So I think one should be a bit more careful. I would be a bit more careful about distinguishing between the different pieces of the administration. But I think the core of your point is absolutely right, that on questions of religion, on questions of race, and in the invocation of quote-unquote inner city violence in cities like Chicago, the president has not shown himself to have an equal measure of concern for all Americans. Consistent with a campaign that, you know, appealed in very lightly disguised ways to the sense that perhaps many white Americans have that their economic and cultural status is slipping, has run as a president for some but not all Americans. And when that translates into policy, as I think it did when the first travel ban was promulgated and employed against green card holders who have a right to reside but who are also nationals of the affected countries, with respect to the Dreamers, and the way in which policy decisions of that kind impact not just non-citizens but many citizens who are related to, married to, live with, depend for their business on Dreamers. I think we've seen a kind of systematic callousness about the interests of some, but not others. So I think the core of your question is absolutely correct.
So what do you think would happen if there were a terrorist attack in this country along the lines of what we've seen in the UK? Because you mention in your article at The Guardian, Aziz, how would Trump handle a terror attack? You mentioned in your article that after 9/11, the FBI had a program called Pentabomb that was an aggressive use of immigration laws, detained hundreds of suspects, often based on ethnicity or perceived face. And Arab and Muslim communities were swept with voluntary interviews that at times resulted in arrests on insubstantial premises. So would there be large-scale arrests, dragnets, racial profiling? Would that be your expectation?
Well, I obviously have to hope otherwise. I think all of those measures are unwarranted and, frankly, inefficacious, particularly given the forms that the risk now poses. But unfortunately, I think our experience with recent crises, not security crises, but international security crises and natural disasters, suggest that this is an administration that places an emphasis, as you say, on wanting to appear tough, but with very little regard to the underlying dynamic or forces that cause a policy problem. And I think that suggests that it is likely that we would see a reiteration, a re-upping of many of the measures and that used in the wake of the 9/11 attack. And those were measures principally that involved the criminal law and the FBI's investigative authorities, but also the immigration authorities' use of their powers. And they have, as we know, we now get to see very extensive detention-related powers too. I would expect to see some of the tools that have been used by other countries since 9/11 adopted. And I think, ironically enough, France is a very good lesson here about the ways in which emergency powers can be used. France has been very aggressive in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attack in closing mosques, deporting imams, engaging in warrantless searches that are seemingly targeted by little more than ethnicity or race in ways that have had substantial alienating effects on the French Muslim community. In the long term, I think these tactics, while they play well to a political audience, are inefficacious. It doesn't work to use dragnets, particularly when the use of the dragnet is chilling the flow of information from these communities. As we've seen many, many times before in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency context, treating race or ethnicity or religion as a proxy for risk is a guaranteed way to compound or exacerbate or expand the number of rights violations without doing much that's very effective.
Well, the British obviously have a much greater problem than the United States has, and I think it stems from the difference. As far as I know, the U.S. does not accept returnees from the ISIS war zones, those that have fought with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, whereas the French let them back and the British let them back as well. They watch them, but watching people 24/7 is an extremely expensive, and many of them have slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
So to that extent, do you agree that the U.S. situation is a preferable one, not to allow jihadis to return?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that are going on here. The first is just that the rate of movement from European countries, but particularly England and France, although Germany, I think, has had a relatively high per capita rate. The rate of people going to Syria was higher than the U.S. That's partly a function of proximity, and it's partly a function of the kinds of social communities that you have in Europe that you don't have in America. But more generally, in the longer term, the United States has been much more successful in integrating Muslims into American society when they've been recent immigrants. And I hasten to add that there have been Muslims in the United States since before the nation became a nation. There were many, many Muslims who were slaves who were brought over from the early 1600s onwards. But recent Muslim migration to the United States has generally been far wealthier than analog migrations in Europe. And you've seen people move into professional jobs, intermarry, and find pathways into American society in a way that the more closed social structures and the more tightly controlled labor market in Europe did not allow. And so I think those are the deep and long-term reasons why the domestic problem is of a different order of magnitude in Europe from the one that's here. I actually don't think that the kind of the policy on returnees is a significant contributor. I think pales in comparison to these other considerations that are much more long term.
Well, just in closing, the British have ubiquitous CCTV, whereas the US doesn't, and it's obviously been a tool that's been used in tracking some of these perpetrators of these terrorist attacks. And I think it was even used in the most recent one in finding these two suspects that they have.
Correct.
Would you, you're a civil libertarian, how do you feel about CCTV? We don't have as much as the Brits do. Should we have more CCTV?
I think that's an interesting question. I actually don't know how much CCTV we have in major metropolitan areas. I suspect it's much more than people think. When you add not just the CCTV that's run by the state, but also CCTV that's run by private companies, many apartment buildings, many retail and businesses have CCTV that covers the streets outside their properties. It was precisely this kind of private CCTV that's important in the Boston Marathon investigation, for example. So I'm not sure the difference is that great. And I do think there's a difference between CCTV and other kinds of surveillance, but this gets us far afield, but there are increasing ways in which CCTV footage can be used to extract private information in a way that would not have been possible even 5 or 10 years ago. So, for example, there's a widely reported study out of Stanford about how researchers can use machine learning to infer whether somebody is straight or gay based upon their image in CCTV footage. I think one needs to think hard about how and where CCTV footage is used. One needs to think hard about how the government can employ such information, but I certainly don't think it's the case that it shouldn't be used at all or it should be minimized. But the way it is used, I think, presents some interesting and difficult questions.
Well, Aziz Haque, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And he has a forthcoming book, How Constitutional Democracies Are Lost and Saved. And he has an article at The Guardian, How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Jose Benavides and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.